Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Gay Watson. She has a PhD in Religious Studies from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. She trained as a psychotherapist with the Karuna Institute in Core Process, a Buddhist-inspired psychotherapy. She's very much concerned with the dialogue between Buddhist thought, psychotherapy and the mind sciences, and is the author of Beyond Happiness, Deepening the Dialogue Between Buddhism, Psychotherapy and the Mind Sciences. And she's here to talk to us today about her latest book, A Philosophy of Emptiness. So hello, Gay. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, well, could you maybe start, Gay, by telling us a bit about your background and how you became interested in this topic?
Well, I went back to university rather late in life, having meant to be going at the proper time, i.e. about 18, 19, and then going off and doing something else. And then I would then have read, I think, English literature, and then I was going to read psychology when I was in my later 20s. And somehow I ended up in India studying Hatha Yoga. And so I finally didn't get to university till I had had children and I was in my 40s, yeah, when I went to do a degree in religious studies at SOAS. Uh-huh. At the same time, I was training as a psychotherapist.
Yeah.
So I did those two trainings sort of at the same time. And at the end of my BA, I think we had the opportunity to do a research project for a unit or something. And because I was living in Devon and also had children, this was a good option for me. So I brought the two things together and wrote a research project on Buddhism as an inspiration for contemporary psychotherapy.
Okay.
And someone who was taking that particular course suggested that I might like to do this, had I thought of doing this for a PhD.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, what a lovely idea. So I then proceeded to do this over the subsequent years, and out of that came a book called The Resonance of Emptiness, which was subtitled Buddhism for an Inspiration for Contemporary Psychotherapy. So this was the world I was in. And as you said, the other book, Beyond Happiness, came out of that when it was difficult to be interested in psychotherapy without taking note of the exciting things that were going through in the neuroscientific world. And particularly, I came across and was very interested in the work of Francisco Varela.
Yeah.
Somewhere along this time, I think, Stephen Batchelor and Guy Claxton and I set up a conference at Dartington Hall in Devon, around which we were all living at the time. Psychology of Enlightenment, I think it was called. I seem to remember Francisco got up and said the title is an oxymoron. But that led me on to sort of into the neuroscientific world as best I could, being scientifically illiterate. Anyway, out of all this, I think somewhere along the line came a request, and I was commissioned to write a book on, would I be interested to write a book on A Philosophy of Emptiness?
All right.
So it was not my idea, but strangely and wonderfully, the request came to me in an email, which I picked up in the sort of empty heart of America. It was rather wonderful. I had been out on somewhere near Lake Powell on the edge of the Navajo Nation, and in a sort of deserted Wi-Fi cafe on a Sunday, I picked up an email saying, would I be interested perhaps in considering writing, you know, a book on A Philosophy of Emptiness? And I remembered my supervisor saying to me, you're obsessed with emptiness. So I thought this was a call I couldn't possibly refuse. And the rest came out of this. But The publishers did not want a Buddhist book. They wanted a much more wider ranging book, not a scholastic book on emptiness in Buddhism. And I thought this was an absolutely wonderful invitation.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think that I said as long as I could say that, you know, that the most central and best thought out philosophy of Buddhism is without doubt provided by Buddhist thought.
Yeah.
I was very happy to then bounce off from that and explore ideas of emptiness in all, you know, sort of areas. And I think at the end of all that, in a strange way, I think I feel a little bit more like a curator. You know, I curated an exhibition of Buddhism. It's almost the best analogy. I have followed you know, traces of Buddhism in all sorts of places and had an amazingly good time doing this.
Would you also see yourself as sort of a synthesizer or even a magpie in a sort of way?
Definitely a magpie, yes. Yes, I think, you know, a curator, a collagist, you know, something like that. And definitely a magpie, yes.
Okay, brilliant. What would be nice then, Gay, is for you to give us a sort of overview of the book. What is a philosophy of emptiness?
Okay, well, I decided that I really wanted to start from the experiential. You know, what does emptiness mean? And then, of course, we get very different answers, because to a lot of people, and I go into this, and I think at the end of the book, I do question the translation of shunyata as emptiness, because you just mention emptiness and everyone thinks it's lack, it's non-existence.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found it was quite fascinating in the, two or three years I was writing the book, people would come and say, how's your book on silence getting on, or nothing, or, you know, nobody ever remembered emptiness. It was quite funny. And I also found that I had a very different experience. You know, I asked a couple of friends, what does emptiness mean to you? And one said, something missing.
Yeah.
And I asked a couple of artist friends who both gave a completely positive twist. You know, it's opportunity, it's what comes before form. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about the experiential first. And then I went from there to Buddhism, because I felt, as I said, that the Buddhist ideas of emptiness provide the most thought out philosophy of emptiness. You know, I started, actually, to go back, I wanted to start the book with an empty page saying emptiness, and the page should remain empty, and then go over, but a philosophy and the dialogue must continue.
Sure.
However, my publishers didn't like that idea.
That sounds a great idea, that.
So I wanted, you know, what is your response, your experiential response to an empty page?
Yeah.
And what is your response to a page of text? You know, anyway, I think I wrote that out in the end. But then I went on to Buddhism, and very much centered in a way on Nagarjuna and his exposition of emptiness of self, and then his exposition of emptiness and the indivisibility of emptiness and interdependence. The very fact that things are empty does not mean they are non-existent. It means they are empty of permanence, identity, an intrinsic independence.
Yeah.
And why? Because they are interdependent, the result of interdependent processes. I mean, traditionally, you know, Buddhist Madhyamaka thought would say there are three main reasons for this interdependence. It relies on the dependence of anything on causes and conditions, the dependence of everything on parts and wholes, and thirdly, the dependence on things on designations and conventions. So really, you've got this emptiness, fullness, you know, as in the Heart Sutra, emptiness and form are two sides of the same coin.
Okay.
And that is very much my feeling of the presentation of emptiness. And then I went on and talked about Taoism, which was possibly a little bit earlier, but in a way I don't think has been so influential, because it's been more poetic.
Okay.
And has, you know, really, then a lot of later Taoism went into sort of more magical realms, and I think on the whole it's been much less influential than Buddhist thought on the topic. So from there I went to the Greeks, which for me was terribly exciting because I knew nothing about, I did not know the complete reflection and so much of the resonance, you know, and obviously I think there must have been direct influence.
Well, there were trade routes, weren't there, at the time?
Trade routes from early on, the university at Taxila, you know, all sorts of things. But and Pyrrho, I think it was, went with Alexander the Great. All these wonderful links. And then there are, if you go into the text, there are things in text, particularly of Pyrrhonian skepticism, that, you know, could have, they are so resonant with what Nagarjuna wrote. They're just the same tone. They're singing the same song. So that was terribly exciting. But then, in a way, you could also see they were not the people and the texts that came down into our Western Greek-oriented mainstream. Mm-hmm. They were sort of peripheral. And they got lost. And then I think for a very long time with the coming of Christianity, all thoughts of emptiness kind of disappeared and the West became overwhelmed with philosophies and thoughts of substance and presence.
Yeah.
To a huge degree. And so then I went on a little bit about that. And
why do you think that happened? Why do you think there was a need for clarity as opposed to a sort of tolerance of ambiguity that existed before? What happened there?
I think it was less that than it was faith. You know, there's a wonderful philosopher called Pierre Hadot who wrote, you know, Philosophy as a Way of Life.
Yeah.
And you know, his argument, which I think is very good, is that at that time it became a matter of faith. Not only did we lose the ambiguity, but also practice and theory became separated.
Okay.
The practice went on in the monasteries and the theory went into the academies.
Yeah.
And so this sort of, you know, blood relationship between them was broken. And then I think, I don't know, I think you can see it in Buddhism too. You can see it almost in any religion, almost perhaps in any philosophy, there is this moment when an idea, a concept, a path becomes codified.
Yeah.
And ambiguity is usually the loser in this in this process.
Yeah.
You know, people, I do think there is a deep psychological trait. Buddhism would call it grasping, but we want certainty. Through absolute every field, you know, ambiguity is thrown out in the search for certainty.
I suppose it's safer and in some ways more comfortable at times. I mean, it's a lot messier in the middle, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Completely. Yes, yes. I see this, you know, it's you see it in so many ways that things that become are an antidote to a well-held belief becomes grasped as strongly as the belief that it was initially denying. You know, you see it in a sort of religious atheism. You know, it's probably the easiest example of this.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and then, so that was, you looked at the Greeks, and then what did you move on to?
Then, really, there is a gap, I think, until you get to modernity and post-modernity with some sort of wonderful figures on the outside, almost lone voices, often heretical voices, you know, Meister Eckhart, Duns Scotus, religious voices, the Romantics.
Would you say that with the mystics there was more a focus on experience than absolute truths?
I would think so.
And why do you think... Why do you think those traditions were somehow allowed to survive in those very dominant traditions of faith? I suppose, well, they were persecuted, weren't they? It was tough.
They were persecuted. Somehow, you know, they managed to hang on. I don't know how widespread they were. You know, obviously they came back. There are many, many voices that kind of disappeared for a while and then have come back as the climate gets more friendly towards what they are expressing.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So, and you know, now we possibly read them, we give them a greater welcome.
Yeah.
But so basically, I sort of almost went from there until a more contemporary view, you know, and in, if you had to take a sort of a line, because obviously the history goes further back and back to the ideas of the Enlightenment, but to, if you had to sort of flag something up, I suppose it's sort of around the time of Nietzsche and Darwin and, you know, God is dead and evolution comes in, and then there's, you know, then we get into our the beginnings of the modern and going on into the modern and the postmodern, where, you know, that was the exciting bit. I found echoes of emptiness everywhere, not a philosophy of emptiness, but signs of emptiness, experiences of emptiness, ideas of emptiness, concepts of emptiness.
Do you think Darwin played a big part in that? Because, like, a fundamental aspect of evolution is indeterminacy, which ran counter to this view that the world was mechanistic and ordered.
Well, I think so. I mean, if you look, you just see indeterminacy bouncing out everywhere. I mean, when you think of science and you think of, you know, Einstein, and then you bounce forward, you have indeterminacy in the quantum world, the whole, suddenly we are moving from, even though it's by no means mainstream, even now, though everybody knows it is, even though we know that reality is far more complex, far more indeterminate, far more, you know, difficult to describe.
Sure, yeah. What about scientific method as well? I mean, arguably good science relies on an understanding of uncertainty, and that to actually have a robust theory or hypothesis, it needs to be open to being proven wrong, that it's falsifiable, basically. Do you think that's part of this process too?
I do. I think all of these things were sort of chipping away at old certainties.
Okay. And then you mentioned the Romantics and this notion of the sublime. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I think the sublime, again, brings in a way, it brings in ineffability.
Yeah.
It brings in experience. And this was something that evoked awe and terror and was greater than one's understanding, if you like. More so. So I think it was a sort of something that invited you to change your frame of reference, if you like.
Okay, so you explored the arts in quite detail in the book. Why do you think the arts are such an integral part of a philosophy of emptiness?
Because I think, I mean, it came initially because I kept bumping into ideas of emptiness in art. In all the different fields of art. And I would find something that an artist had written somewhere, or about their piece of visual art, about a dance piece, and it was singing the songs of emptiness. So I just went curating them, you know. And it was absolutely wonderful. I think artists, they pay attention, and they are aware of things, and they pay attention to their own experience, and then they see things quite freshly. And more in contemporary art practice, I think, rather than just telling a tale or showing us the world, artists are trying to, today, to enable us to have an experience, to share an experience. I mean, so much of art is actually overtly experiential. You know, I talk about artists in this field, such as, you know, James Turrell and Elifor Eliasson, but there are many, many others. And I think they're trying to convey that experience to us. And a lot of these experiences seem to touch on emptiness, interrelationship, indeterminacy.
So do you think the arts are in a way of cultivating the tolerance of ambiguity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. I mean, in a way, writing novels has always been a way of sharing into the experience of someone other.
Sure, yeah. And you mentioned attention there. So it's also cultivating awareness and attention. I used to draw when I was a teenager, and I've just gone back and started doing a drawing class, and just how wonderfully absorbing it is. We had to fill in this questionnaire and saying, why are you here? And which I found a little bit irritating, because they want you to tick all these boxes and stuff. But I just said, I'm here to draw and paint. Not particularly to improve my drawing and painting, but just actually to it's that process of paying attention, which is lovely. I've just really found something again.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. Because I think there is something in paying attention, not for a purpose, you know. It may come out in a drawing, but you're actually paying attention. And I think that's very rare in this book. I will say some more about that in a minute. Because I looked at traces. I was following the spore, sort of a bloodhound following a spore of emptiness. And, you know, the difficulty was to make it just a tremendous list, and I had to say, look, this is one person's trail on the traces of emptiness in the contemporary world, and then I had to sort of try and bring the book together. And at the end of it, I think, you know, in the last chapter, I sort of came to the fact that rather than a philosophy of emptiness in today's world, it was more a path, it was more an approach, it was kind of an attempt, because our Western culture is so predicated on the valuation of substance and presence. Mm-hmm. This look at emptiness was almost asking initially for a sort of background foreground reversal, a new way of looking through the eyes of emptiness. I mean, the ultimate end of the path, I think, would be a balancing of the both, you know, a valuation of both. But because our normal ways, our default mode is so much on the side of substance and presence, we have to make a huge effort to get to the other side, or even to get to a middle road that sees there is something else. So I came to the end and thinking that emptiness, you know, really is a path. It's an approach. And in a way, I came to see it as openness rather than emptiness.
Why?
Because it is an openness, a sort of openness to indeterminacy, interdependence, a lack of fixity.
Yeah, so it's like an embrace, in a sense.
Exactly. And to try and get rid of some of the baggage so you could actually see freshly out of our normal habits of substance and material and, you know, presence. And I sort of came, there were several aspects of this path. I thought, you know, I came to that it should be close to experience. It had a kind of therapeutic aim, which is to rebalance. Yeah. It is utterly centered in awareness and in attention, both to discover an alternative and then to live with openness to it. And this attention will show us interdependence and the complexity, the not self of self, or self as a process rather than self as the center of our world, which we then paste onto all our experience.
You gave a lovely little anecdote, a story about a little boy.
Well, I think it's just a child sort of growing up saying, but Daddy, you know, if myself is permanent, how can I ever grow up? And a child can get it, but we sort of don't. I had a wonderful experience once, which I was riding on a horse near to my home in Devon, and I was riding down a little lane. And it had been a very, very frosty night, and it was still cold, and the sun was coming, was lighting up. All the frost had just melted, and so the whole hedgerows were covered with little droplets of melting ice, and the sun lit them all up. So it was like a diamond path. It was absolutely spectacular. You know, I gasped at the glory of it all. And we walked through it. And then I turned around on my horse to try and grasp one last look at it. But by then, of course, I was blocking out the sun. I was turning. I was facing the wrong way. I was between the sun and these beautiful frost-filled little water droplets. And, you know, it had gone. And I realized two things out of that. One, I was trying to hold it for longer than I should have done. And two, what was in the way? Myself.
That's great.
It's the incredible little parable. But yes, so I think all of that and the kind of ineffability and relevant to your whole organization, that it was a central path. It is a middle way. Any philosophy of emptiness is a middle way. A middle way between chaos and fixity, between this and that.
Do you think it's a philosophy of emptiness is essentially an ethical practice?
I do. And I think, you know, maybe I'm looking at this from a very Buddhist point of view, but I think if you do get yourself out of the way, if you do pay attention to things and to other people, compassion does arise. It's a feeling compassio, I feel with, you know, it is a feeling with, and that evokes an ethical stance.
Sure. Can we just, I'd just like to go and unpack a couple of things that I found very interesting in the book. One particular insight that I found very enlightening was this major distinction in, you suggest in, well, I think another author, between Chinese and Western thought, that Chinese thought is structured by a logic of respiration rather than a logic of perception.
Isn't that wonderful?
That was
one of my real discoveries. A French writer called François Julien, who writes a sinologist, and this wonderful idea of a logic of the in-breath and the out-breath. The one leads inexorably, inevitably to the other. It's an in and an out, which is so different from our either this or that, and the, you know, the excluded middle. It is in the Taoist symbol, of course, in which, you know, the one is inside the other. Just wonderful. It makes sense of so much, doesn't it?
Sure, yeah. How do you think the work of Lakoff and Johnson on embodied meaning relates to a philosophy of emptiness?
You know, I do, sort of peripherally, but to me, it makes sense because it hugely underlines interdependence, the interdependence of body and mind, of mind, body and world.
Do you think in some respects it also pulls the rug under the feet of metaphysical beliefs, of dogma, by depriving them arguably of their founding assumptions about the meaning of the language that they depend on?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it possibly, I should have mentioned language there first, because of course it is all about language. But yes, I think it does. I think it brings brings us back to our embodiment. It shows, I mean, I think its exposition of metaphor is wonderful. And I think when I was saying that one of the things of ineffability as being one of the qualities of a philosophy of emptiness, it's not so much ineffability, it's more playing, more holding language more lightly, understanding that so much of the language we use, as they said, is dead metaphor. You know, it allows you to hold it more lightly, and I think emptiness is all about holding things more lightly, you know.
And then Ian McGilchrist is also an influence, and you talk about quite a bit in the book, on his work on brain lateralization. He suggests that perhaps everything that exists does so only in relationships like music.
Completely. I think that's such a lovely idea and so beautifully put. I find his work absolutely enthralling and tremendously interesting. And I love the idea. I sort of, in a strange way, see that, you know, some of my feeling about the hegemony of presence and substance is sort of alongside the overmastery of the left hemisphere, if you like, you know, that we're in the same sort of territory. The other thing I absolutely love, he said something about, you know, he talks so much about attention and the fact that, you know, with our attention, we pretty much make our worlds. There's an incredible quote of his somewhere that I haven't got just here. But and for me, having finished, when I came to the end of A Philosophy of Emptiness, I knew I wanted to write another book called A Practice of Attention.
Fascinating. Oh, well, that sounds really interesting.
Which would kind of, again, curate, you know, not a deep, terribly academic book, but to look at attention through the eyes of all sorts of expert practitioners in different fields, again going into the arts.
I suppose when you think about meditation both in the East and the West, it appears to have a shared common focus, namely that of attention to the present moment. Would you say that in a sense attention is the key to spiritual practice?
Actually, I think it is. I really do, because if you're not paying attention, how can you interact sort of ethically or well with the people you're around? You can have the best ideas in the world and be an intolerable person to live with or to be around. You know, I'm sure we've all met them. But there is something. I remember years ago, one of the people who wrote first on the interface of psychotherapy and Buddhism, John Wellwood, had coined this term spiritual bypassing, which was a lot of people who actually gained very good meditative. So this is interesting in two ways, because they might be very, very good at meditation, and thus they would think they were spiritually, you know, enhanced human beings. But they hadn't done their work on the ordinary personality level.
Yeah.
But that's another form of attention, isn't it? I think a true understanding of meditation, however much there is the practice on the cushion, the formal practice, it has to go along with the understanding that actually, as in the ox herding pictures, you eventually go back into the marketplace.
I think that often that can be the case, that like meditation or mindfulness can be almost absolutized without taking into account other factors. Like, you know, you hear examples of mindfulness now being done in the army so people can be better snipers. And so attention just by itself is not sufficient, is it?
I think it isn't, because, you know, it has to go along with intention and various other things. But you will get a good attention and probably be a better sniper, but, you know, who knows? Who knows? Maybe you might also not want to snipe at the end of it. I really don't know. I think these are very difficult questions that a lot of people are sort of worrying about. But certainly to take anything out, I mean, this is going back to emptiness and interdependence. It's not a great idea to take anything out of its context.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, it's the bigger picture, isn't it?
Okay. You suggest that Pyrrhonism is arguably not a view or a belief, but a practice. Could you say what you mean by that, and how is that related to A Philosophy of Emptiness?
Yes, I think, you know, Pyrrho initially was in the era where philosophy was a way of life. You know, it was a way to eudaimonia, the good life, the well-balanced life, the healthy life. It was a way to keep you from anxiety or ataraxia. And I think what we think of as skepticism today has probably been slightly altered. I know Adrian Kuzminski, who writes very well about Pyrrhonism, as does Thomas McEvely, they both say that initially Pyrrho, you know, who lived in about 4th century BC, his actual writings or words have only come down to us in the writings of Sextus Empiricus, which was 2nd century AD. And during this time, and since, there has been a sort of shift from the idea of doubt as a tool of inquiry to that of doubt as a belief. So now we think it's a sort of absolute doubt, that everything has to be doubted. Whereas, in fact, Pyrrhonian skepticism did allow some things to be evident. What it was, you could take what was evident, but you should doubt everything else. And what was evident was the immediate involuntary experience, which was then called appearances and included both sensations and thought. And these were evident, and thus, day to day and pragmatically, you could accept these. Anything else would be built on top of these and, you know, should be doubted.
Yeah, so with that, then that is, in a sense, very empowering. So arguably, that you can then proportion your beliefs to the evidence. You know, the degree of confidence that you have in your belief is proportionate to the amount of evidence that is there to support them. So then one belief can actually be more objective than another, in a sense.
I would think so. And it's also taking it back, possibly a little bit like Lakoff and Johnson. You're going back, as they do with language, to embodiment. You are going back to a sensation.
Sure, yeah. Okay. But is there anything that I've not asked you?
I don't think so. I mean, I read, you know, when you asked me to do this, I did go on the website, and absolutely, I think I'm a sort of, I have become a natural middle weyer, so I'm hugely interested. And, you know, I cannot think how many times in conversations I'm not saying, but, you know, it's another wretched middle way between X or Y or Z, you know, in so many different contexts.
Yeah.
You know, the ancient Greeks like balance, you know, it is back to that idea. But, you know, I think there's that lovely, I believe it's a Tibetan saying, dancing on the razor's edge. It's not always a wide, sunny path, the middle, you know.
Exactly. Okay, my last question, Gay, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
I guess read the book. I do have a website. I'm not very good about, you know, keeping it up. People have emailed me. And otherwise, yeah, read the books, I think. You know, occasionally I put my head over the parapet, but not an awful lot.
Okay, well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and an absolutely enthralling conversation. And I'm sure our listeners will really benefit from what you've spoken about today.
Well, thank you very much. You're doing great stuff here. And, you know, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very grateful.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.